Hello, this is Rob Weinert-Kent. I'm a senior editor at American Theater Magazine. This is AT Off Script. And today we're talking about the 38th annual Humana Festival of New American Plays at the Actors Theater of Louisville. It ran March 4th through April 6th, 2014. And I'm joined by two critics who were there from the American Theater Critics Association, which had its annual conference and presented awards. Today, we're with two critics. Are you both members of the American Theater Critics Association? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, why don't you introduce yourselves in turn, Erin?
I'm Erin Keene. I'm the arts reporter and theater critic for WFPL. That's Louisville, Kentucky's NPR station.
And Bill?
I'm Bill Hirschman. I'm the founder, chief critic, and editor for FloridaTheaterOnStage.com.
All right.
We're a professional, vetted, edited, and advertising-supported website that reviews all the professional theater in the three counties down here, as well as writing feature stories. And we also come up to New York and do reviews up there.
Great. Well, I wanted to just start with the general comments and thoughts about Humana. This is the 30th annual, as I said. This is about the second year that Les Waters, the new artistic director, was responsible for the programming. Is that correct?
I think it's the third, right?
The third, okay.
Well, and I mean, I don't know, responsible. The way that they've always explained it to me is that it's really a group decision, especially among the literary and artistic staff. So nobody over at Actors Theater is going to claim primary responsibility for programming the Humana Festival.
Right, right. So, in fact, just looking at it on the page, the names I see, the groups I see a lot of continuity in the sorts of people and the sorts of plays that they're programming. Or would that be fair to say? Or do you feel like there's been a definite, you've seen a change between Mark Masterson and Les Waters?
I see some continuity. I mean, this is Jordan Harrison's fifth Humana Festival
right. That
he's had a play in. Lucas Nath's third, although mm-hmm. his have all been fairly recent. And then Ann Bogart and City Company have certainly been longtime collaborators with Actors Theater. So I think maybe just the new faces are interesting. Kimberly and Dorothy Fortenberry have never had a Humana Festival play yet. So they're kind of interesting, but there's always, you know, a handful of folks who are new to the festival as well.
Right.
I also think that, though, that there is a certain tone and to all of the works. You know, I've only been there 3 years, but for the 3 years I've been there, there's certainly been an adventurous and edgy tone to it that certainly is right up Les Waters' domain and bailiwick. Clearly, a lot of these works speak directly to his sensibility, I would think.
Yeah, no, I was struck again by, I think City Company hasn't been there in a while, but they mm-hmm. used to be there back in the day with John Jory. So why don't we go through the plays one by one? I just sort of wanted to get, I know you've both written about it, but I just wanted to just sort of talk back and forth. I don't know how much disagreement we're gonna find, but Partners by Dorothy Fortenberry, you mentioned, Erin. Erin, why don't you tell us what that play is about, what it's like, and then we'll start talking about, was it any good?
Well, there's always, it seems like in the festival, always one play that's about contemporary youngish folks in urban centers with their contemporary problems.
Right.
This would be Partners this time. It's about two best friends, Claire and Ezra, and they want to open a food truck together. But Claire, for a lot of reasons, is dragging her feet while Ezra is more and more urgent about the project. But the title Partners is kind of interesting because it's as much about their partnership, their friendship, their business partnership, but also their partnerships with their respective partners, Claire with her husband and Ezra with his boyfriend. So it's lots of stuff kind of mixed in about money, friendship, relationships. A lot of interesting questions raised in this play.
Hmm. And Bill?
Well, my sense was that, and I felt like there were several themes going simultaneously, obviously, but the one that I certainly seemed to see was how the acquisition of money can undermine relationships. Both sets of these relationships on the surface seemed to be moving along quite well until money came into it. And when Claire suddenly comes into a great deal of money, this creates all kinds of problems for these folks and ends up dividing them when they didn't expect that was going to happen. So it seems very simple, but you know, the damage that money can do, and more in the sense that money exposes cracks in these relationships that were probably there, but the participants weren't aware of.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned food truck, Aaron. Where is this? What city is it set in?
It's set in New York, in Brooklyn, I believe.
Brooklyn,
and but it's also set in 2008. So it's right. So it's before the gay marriage ban was struck down in New York. And so that's a big plot point there as well.
Okay.
So it's sort of bizarre. It's set in the very recent past, which I don't know if that works or not. For a brand new play.
Not quite a period piece.
Right.
It's fair to say it's also a comedy, right?
Yeah, it's funny. It's very, the character of Ezra in particular is pretty funny. And that's a tight line to walk between being a funny character who happens to be the gay best friend and being the gay funny gay best friend, you know?
Okay,
like one's a real character and one's stock.
He's very witty. I mean, in fact, all four characters are very intelligent and very articulate and have no trouble expressing what's going on in each other's brain. It's just that each discovers that they don't know the other as well as they thought.
Right. In general, thumbs up, you would say, for this one. It does sound like the kind of play that we would probably see in New York eventually. And around the country, if it's at that level of craft.
Yeah, I think it's very accessible for one thing. And it's not naturalistic, but it certainly is not a terribly stylistic play or a hard to access play. So in that sense, you'll see it in New York. I think you may well see it around the country. We have a company down here that specializes in LGBT themed work. And I won't at all be surprised to see that show up here in the next couple of seasons.
Right.
The director was Lila Neugebauer.
Oh, yeah.
Neugebauer.
Neugebauer.
Or Neugebauer.
Neugebauer, yes.
I've had some practice with that one.
That's right. You're in broadcasting.
she's assisted on a number of plays here for a while, so we're familiar with Lila a little bit in New York. But that's great. One final note. What's the length of the play? Is it a big, meaty two-act, or is it a 90-minute?
All of the plays in this year's festival were done without intermission. I think this one was maybe clocked in at about 2 hours.
Interesting. Without intermission.
You probably could build in an intermission if you want. And so I'm not sure if this was a... if that was a decision that was made on the page necessarily, or if that was a production decision.
Oh, okay. Well, let's move on to the next one. It's got a lot of play. The Christians by Lucas Naith, which I learned to pronounce as well. tell me about that, Bill. Just sort of tell us what it's about and what you thought of it.
I was really, again, impressed. It was very accessible, I thought. Lucas, wrote last season's Death Tax, which was quite successful. This one's very interesting. It's basically set at the mortgage burning ceremony for a mega church somewhere, the kind that has, beautiful blonde wood and huge choirs, and obviously is very well heeled. And the play begins with the minister, who looks like he just walked off a televangelist series, who basically comes right out to the audience and begins a sermon that probably lasts 15 or 20 minutes. And in it, he is celebrating the resurgence of the church and its success. And then he begins to tell a story about, a long story, about a conference that he just came back from, in which another pastor talked about a young man who had walked into a burning building to save his sister's life, and he saved her, but he died. But because the young man had not accepted Jesus as his savior, everyone at this conference accepted the concept that this young man was going to hell, even though he did this wonderful thing. And the pastor who's speaking to us reveals the fact that he has come to the decision that there is no such thing as hell, that that's a misreading of the Bible. There is, in fact, probably no such thing as Satan. And the concept that you will go to hell if you lived a wonderful Christian life just without accepting Jesus as your Savior makes no sense in the concept of having a God of love. It's as if you have walked into a church service. It actually starts off with a choir singing for about 10 minutes.
Right.
At that point, the other people on the dais start having problems. They speak to him, an associate pastor who has been a sort of a renegade, but is actually more conservative than he,
right,
disagrees with him and eventually breaks off from the church, taking with him almost everyone in the congregation.
Right, right.
The interesting thing about this show, which really fascinated me, is for the liberal-minded people in the audience, they really suddenly sided with this guy. But in fact, Lucas's viewpoint is not that simple.
Sure.
He calls into serious question the hubris and the arrogance of the pastor for turning the church inside out and essentially destroying it. Many of us saw parallels to Enemy of the People.
Oh, right.
And essentially destroying everything and everyone around him for what he thought was the best reason.
You know, the thing that I thought was most interesting about how Nath told this story was, you know, I felt myself just as an audience member really on the side of the minister during his big reveal sermon. You know, I'm like, yeah, gotta love, you know, this kid should be going to heaven. That's just. And then over the course of the play, I found myself really on the side of characters with whom I would not agree with theologically, but emotionally. They kind of won me over. And it's that kind of Lucas Nath's writing is really skillful like that in how he kind of reels you into the story and then makes you really question, you know, whose side are you on, even in a story that really objectively has no sides.
Yeah, he isn't trying to get you, I don't think, to take sides so much as asking questions about motivations, whether the way you do things, the pastor turns out to be a somewhat flawed character, which is interesting. And again, I don't think Lucas wants you to come out. He may want you to come out with feeling one way or another, but I don't think that his play itself is taking a side. It's asking questions, not answering them.
Interesting. Do you feel like this is a play we'll probably also see? It's a finished, very finished play, craft-wise.
Yeah, it only needs 5 or 6 speaking parts. One of the things that really worked, and one of the great things about Humana, is that they have a large budget. And that meant that they could create this gorgeous set that represents a major church. And it also had about a 30-piece, 20-piece choir behind, which really did set the scene and gave you a sense of the opulence. And that's not something everybody can do. You can find a way around it, obviously.
Well, you know, what they did with that is they just involved a lot of Louisville's community choirs. They didn't hire 30 singers for the duration of the run. They used lots of different singers from different choral groups. And so you could kind of come in and do a couple of shows and then rotate out. So that's a model, I think, that a lot of theaters could use, especially regional theaters.
I will say that the guy that played the lead part, the pastor, was a guy named Andrew Garman. And he was brilliant. He and Les Waters together, who directed it, came up with an absolute, amazingly accurate sense of the cadence that these pastors speak in and a lot of the personality and personas they came across. It was a terrific performance, very well directed for my money.
Let's talk about The Grown-Up, Jordan Harrison. You said, Aaron, it's his fifth play there. So maybe you could tell me a little bit about it and maybe also tell me how it's different or the same or as some of his previous works.
So The Grown-Up is a sort of lyric fantasy about a little boy who turns a magic doorknob that his grandfather gives him and ends up in a sort of alternate reality that looks a lot like maybe his own future. It's a pretty wild flight of fantasy, but that really comes together, I thought, very satisfyingly in the end. It's fairly different from Jordan's last Humana play, which was Maple and Vine in 2011. Had a pretty successful New York run after that and has played, I think, at ACT in San Francisco as well. And Maple and Vine was based in an alternate reality, but a very human constructed, deliberate alternate reality. So the fantasy elements aren't really as much at play there. So with The Grown-Up, I think he just sort of wasn't necessarily thinking about issues of producibility and more like thinking about just what is the play that Jordan wants to write right now. And it was really fun and very charming. And I will say my husband, who goes to many, many plays with me, said that that was his favorite Humana Festival play that he's seen in a very long time. So
really?
From the Civilian.
That's great. And Bill, did you like The Grown-Up as well?
I enjoyed it just simply because I like the imagination running, you know, amok, and the somewhat comic book millennial tones to it, which I enjoyed. It was very gleefully irreverent, and it was a lot of fun. I felt like it was a little undisciplined, which was probably fine. I think that may be what it was trying to achieve. Hmm. But I think it could use a little more focusing. That it needed, for my money, a little more work. But on the other hand, you know, it was trying to be sort of like a 2014 version of Slaughterhouse-Five with the, you know, the sense of place and time bouncing all over the place, at least for my money. It was a little hard to get your feet on the ground, but I don't think that was unintentional. I think you were supposed to feel at sea because so was the character.
You mentioned, Aaron, that you didn't think he was thinking about producibility. Was it a large cast show?
No, fairly small. People okay. played multiple roles. You know, there's some interesting conventions that he used, like characters who were on stage but maybe not actively participating in a scene would narrate the scene also at the same time. So okay. Language-wise, he was doing some stuff that was a little less conventional than his last play.
Yeah, I know he's definitely known for stylization and alternate realities of some kind or another in his work.
Yeah, I think The Grown-Up is going to be a tougher sell to other theaters than Mabel and Vine was. Mabel and Vine had a strong concept that you could really sell. The Grown-Up, it might have to be a case of people saw it and liked it and now want to produce it.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you had sort of had to, you had to be there kind of play?
A little bit, I think. Right. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, I think it's going to be difficult to read on the page for a lot of conventional and mainstream theaters, regional theaters, to get their head where his is at. But seeing it explains clearly what he was going for. But on the other hand, there are a lot of unconventional theaters and people looking for edgy work that may be able to see on the page what, in fact, the guy really wants to accomplish. You know, as someone who reads a great number of plays that they don't see, you know, there is a real disconnect, I think, sometimes between what's in the playwright's head and what ends up on the stage. And to some degree, that doesn't actually end up on the page so that another theater somewhere can actually understand that.
Right. Okay. Well, here's just a sidebar before we go to the next play. Do you all get copies of the scripts and make a point of reading them, or do you just go and see the shows?
I do a little bit of both. I didn't read all of the scripts this year. I read Brownsville Song first because I was pitching a larger feature on it and kind of wanted to see the script to see what my angle was going to be before I saw the show. Some years I read them all, some years I don't. This year I didn't read most of them.
Bill, are you a reader?
No. I'll get them afterwards.
Okay.
And I'll read them sometimes afterwards. In fact, I'm fascinated by the difference between what I've seen and what was on the page. But in general, when I review a new work in general, I will get a copy of the script, but I won't look at it until the show is over. I want to approach it. I'll study it. If the show has been done before, I'll read other reviews,
sure,
et cetera. But I want to come to it pretty much the same way as the audience does.
Let's move on. Since Aaron brought up Brownsville Song, that's our next one on our list here. And Brownsville Song with the parenthetical subtitle B-Side for Trey by Kimber Lee. If you could tell us briefly, give us a thumbnail of what that's about and what you thought of it.
On one hand, it's a relatively conventional idea, the idea of taking a look at a senseless street murder and going backwards and looking at what led up to it and to some degree going forwards, what the aftermath was, and looking at an exemplary young man and the fallout on his family. I really related to it. I thought it was very accessible and very emotional. It really took a headline that we read all the time, which was the point, and brought a real flesh and blood set of characters and family members and situations to back it up. And I think this may get picked up a great deal. I know that some of my colleagues felt it was too conventional an idea, that they'd seen and heard this plot before, seen these characters before, although not all of them. But
right.
I felt it was an unusually affecting piece of work for my money. And I would love to see it done all over the place.
Aaron?
So I agree with Bill. I'm not one of the dissenting colleagues. I loved this play. I feel like some of the criticism that I read of it was maybe a little unfair. Every year we see family drama on stage just about. And I was really happy to see a family drama that was not about why doesn't daddy love me or tell me that he loves me enough, which is honestly usually what those plays are all about. And in this one instead, you know, there was a shadow father figure, but he's not the central wound necessarily in this play. And this is a story that needs to continue to be told. I don't think there's any point of media or cultural saturation with telling the stories of poor working class minorities in urban centers at all in regional theater.
Sure.
I also want to give, I think, props are really due to people. Obviously, the playwright Kimberly has come up with some wonderful dialogue, but also some terrific monologues. This whole thing kicks off with the grandmother doing a absolutely ripped out of her guts monologue saying, yes, this is the 50th of these cases that you've heard of this week, but this was a human being. This was somebody who should not have died. This should not have happened. And Kimberly has a real, for my money, a real talent for both poetic and realistic dialogue. The other person who really deserves a pat on the back is the director, Meredith McDonough, who's the associate artistic director of the theater in general. Her staging was immensely inventive. There's a lot of stuff that I've gone back and realized and found out was not in the script itself, but was in her staging. Hmm. Just ways of making you connect, beautiful stylistic images, as well as getting some really heartrending performances from everybody.
You know, that's going to be the challenge, I think, in restaging this is going to be, do you have a divine? And that's the little girl, the little sister character. I watched Meredith in one rehearsal work with the young actress who's 10 years old, play this 7-year-old. And, you know, most of the time when you see kids on stage, their roles are to be kind of cute and kind of, or just to act natural. But this is a traumatized child in this character. And she has a lot of imaginative work to do. And Meredith got an amazing performance out of this young woman who's clearly very polished already, but she's 10 years old. You know, it's a different process working with an actor that young. So I think the one thing that theaters are going to have to find is they're going to have to find a divine in order to pull this show off.
The divine intervention. All right. The final full-length play to consider is Steel Hammer, created by City Company. And Aaron, you get to tell us about this. I'm just going to give all the credits here because there's a lot of writer credits on this. Music and lyrics are by Julia Wolfe, and original text by Kia Corthron, Will Power, Carl Hancock's Rux, and Regina Taylor. Aaron, tell us about this work.
So this is a very movement and gesture heavy piece, the way City Company's works tend to be, about the myth of John Henry. And so we have four playwrights who have contributed these vignettes that all kind of look at the John Henry myth and its place in American history and culture in a different way. And then there's lots of movement set to Julia Wolfe and Bang on a Can All-Stars music that's also about John Henry. So there is a lot. I mean, there are like 5 hours of play stuffed into a 2-hour bag into this one.
Bill?
Yeah, I think the 5-hour stuffing is a good point. I'm unfamiliar with City's work. I mean, I'm aware of it by its reputation and obviously Ann Bogart's work. But this is the first time I've had a personal connection with it, and I was stunned in both the good and the bad way. Their ability to find staging and movement paradigms I've never seen before, and I was fascinated and absolutely awestruck by their imagination and their inventiveness, and I was just floored for about the first 30 or 40 minutes. But this play went on 2 hours, and it was endless. There is one famous scene. There is one scene we all talk about where I wish somebody put a clock on it, but for 10 minutes, I'll bet money, 10 minutes, all six characters chase each other around a stage for 10 solid minutes. Maybe one would break off, then another one would come on, maybe one would cross the stage in the middle of the circle. It went on for 10 minutes to music that was a cross between Anya and Philip Glass. And the whole production was both brilliant and absolutely the most self-indulgent thing I've ever seen in my life. Does no one tell Ann Bogart, tap on her shoulder and tell her there's an audience that she's actually trying to communicate with? I mean, it struck me as art that is being done literally for art's sake, not right. for communication, not for the audience, not for anybody but the artists who are creating it.
Right.
It was absolutely the central performance by Eric Berryman as John Henry was incredible. The work by everybody involved was incredible. But I will tell you, at the end of the show, which again is 2 hours with no intermission and no way to get out of that small theater, which several people wanted to, is each character leaving the stage and backing out at a speed that was like they were underwater.
Right.
And each one backed out one at a time. And I'm telling you, it took probably 6 or 7 minutes. I'm probably not exaggerating. 6 minutes to get six characters off the stage to end the play when everyone knew it was ending. I've never seen anything like it. Now, maybe many of you have.
Right, right.
Self-indulgent is the word. I don't know where their dramaturg was, but they sure as heck weren't at her elbow saying, "Anne, this is great. This ain't working."
Right. Aaron, do you second that, or do you feel like there's something else going on there?
You know, I agree with a lot of what I heard Bill say, which is there are a lot of moments of inspired genius in this play, and then there are also a lot of moments where things could really be, I thought, tightened up a right. little bit, just for the ease of the audience. But I also want to say that I think that it was a shame that since the music was such a big part of it, that there was no room to do this in the theater, in the Victor Jory in which it was staged. But I think this would be a different play if the music was live. I really do.
Okay.
And I would accept 10 minutes of running in a circle on the stage if we had an amazing band to watch yeah. at that same time. I think that that would actually make it completely different. Now, I hear that that's maybe in the works for the fall in New York. Yeah. I don't know. But with recorded music, it just, you know, after a while, you're like, okay, can we maybe move this scene along a little bit? So I think you have some grace when you have live musicians on stage because it gives you something else to look at also.
What's interesting is that it's encouraging in one sense that it's not just a play market, right? They're not just like, here's a new play that you can produce around it's also defining what a new play is as an ensemble-created, devised work that requires the company that made it to do it. In other words, they're doing, as you said, Bill, art for art's sake. They're still doing that there. They're not just putting up plays that they want to see done elsewhere, you know?
There was a panel discussion the day before, and one of their colleagues was asked, do you see your works in general being transportable?
Yeah.
And said, well, you know, we'd love that to happen, but no, we don't really expect many other people to pick up what it is that we're doing. That's,
right.
They're not against it, but they don't see that as part of their paradigm.
This is City or ATL?
Yeah.
Right, okay, yeah, I thought so.
You know, the thing that I do think is great about watching a City Company play is that you can really see the full, like, their philosophy of theater really come through. You know, mm-hmm. This isn't just we have a script, we're going to direct it, we're going to put on a show. I mean, they're doing something that is specific to their way of thinking about how work should be dramatized on a stage. And you can see that it's different and it's also influential. Unfortunately, I feel like they're still the folks who are doing it. If there's a right way to do it in the right way, sometimes you see a lot of bad imitations of it out there. But
that's true. That's true. And Anne Bogart and City Company have trained a lot of young artists, in which I wouldn't call them all doing bad imitations, but certainly a lot of folks have been influenced by their
yes.
work. I want to hit two other topics quickly. One would be the Remix 38, which is the sort of the interns perform in this, and it's an anthology, I think, around a certain theme. I don't want to go into great depth. If you just want to say maybe each of you mention one highlight from that. It's called Remix 38, and there was the playwrights. You just tell me which ones stood out for you.
Oh, for me, it was both of Basil Crimendahl's pieces.
Okay. Yeah.
Like we do with the construction workers, mm-hmm. having conversations about whether they want something more for their lives or not. And then a very different toned piece called Finger Play, Not a Real Title, about how disparate groups of young people react when they find a finger that someone has accidentally chopped off in a woodcutting accident.
Wow. Pause there. Was there an overarching theme to it, or?
Yeah, the theme was a little more esoteric this year, and I think that's why a lot of it for me didn't really didn't feel like a cohesive showcase. It was an homage to past Humana Festival premieres, but okay. What the literary company did was give the playwrights a little, like, an image or a snippet of dialogue or a motif that they pulled from a previous play, like, you know, Crimes of the Heart or Big Love, that sort of thing. And okay. So then the playwrights were encouraged to just build whatever around that.
Interesting. Yeah. And Bill, apart from Basil, who stood out for you?
The one that actually I felt was very affecting was actually the very last one, And Now I Only Dance at Weddings by Jackie Sibley's Drury, mm-hmm. which involved the entire ensemble but featured Peregrine Heard as, if I understood it right, a woman who is at a wedding and views, basically is looking at a wedding from the outside. And I think there was a whole concept of the idea that you don't have to, that marriage is not the only way a person can define themselves. Hmm. And I felt it was very affecting. The director, who I assume was Ian Frank, did a great deal. You know, there's got to be 10 or 15, 20, I don't know how many interns that are on stage. And the director did a really good job of moving them around the stage and using them in different configurations, which I thought was very impressive. One thing that's interesting, though, I'm using the interns as a jumping off point, but this is very true about the whole festival. And that is, many of these actors and directors and designers are, some of them are from New York and Chicago and Los Angeles and various other big cities. But it underscores the amount of amazing talent that is not A-list, you know, not currently on the A-list on Broadway or in film, that Humana attracts. I don't think even the pieces that I cared less about, I didn't see a single mediocre performance, mediocre direction, mediocre anything, not even average. Everything had a level of quality that was really heartening and encouraging regarding just the status of the talent pool that is out there. And it's a very encouraging thing that people should take away from this festival, that there's that much good work going on out there on every level.
I would love to close on that, but I wanted to touch on one more point and then we should wrap up. And that is the talk by Lauren Gunderson, which your colleague Tim Trainor wrote extensively about, and I didn't see a lot of other coverage. Lauren Gunderson is a playwright, Bay Area-based playwright, who was invited by the American Theater Critics Association to give the keynote address. Did you both find it interesting? Or did you feel like it was territory that had been covered a lot before?
No, I found it very interesting. You know, the one thing that she really kicked off her talk by saying, emphasizing over and over that playwrights and critics were in this together, in this business together, that we were all part of an ecology, which is, you know, I like to think of it as an ecosystem. You know, you have a healthy ecosystem when you have people making art, people offering criticism on art, people consuming art, healthy ecosystem. So I liked that a great deal. I thought it was her perspective on the critic's role in the new play process was interesting, and I thought important, given that we were at the Humana Festival with all of these first productions. The thing that, you know, that she really emphasized was that reviews that tell people don't go see this show are damaging, which is not necessarily the same thing as a negative review of a show. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I've ever written a review that said don't go see this show, but I also don't use star systems or thumbs up, thumbs down, anything like that. So I didn't necessarily feel like she was speaking directly to me on that one, but I think that some of my colleagues probably did.
Right, right. I wonder, Bill, are you a thumbs up, thumbs down kind of writer? Do you feel like you're writing for the...
No, I mean, I do try to tell people what the essence of a show is so that they can determine if it fits in what they like to see. We have a very fragmented theater-going public down here. And you go to certain shows because they are in your bailiwick. One of the things that she said, though, that I thought was really interesting, not just for critics, but for playgoers in general, was to remind us that the play writing paradigm in the 21st century is a lot different than our parents and our grandparents were accustomed to the point that For instance, with the New Play Network's Rolling World Premiere system, very often now, the first time you see a world premiere production, that is not necessarily the show that the playwright wants memorialized for all time. One of the things that Lauren talked about was she's very happy if by the end of the second production she has the script where she wants it. And it's not unusual for a third or fourth production before she has the play developed to the point that she wants to see it written in stone somewhere. And that's something that's very important for both critics and for playgoers to go to, that when they see the words world premiere, that does not mean a finished product like when Death of a Salesman opened in New York in the 1950s.
Well, it's interesting that in the case of Humana, because, you know, those are, as you mentioned, Bill, it's a really high level of production value all around for what are world premieres and really, in most cases, an early draft. So it's an interesting gauntlet to throw down at the beginning of Humana to say, you know, plays need a couple more drafts before you should really start to assess them, and especially assess them regarding their future life.
Well, I'm sure this is true at many places. South Florida is blessed with a handful of companies who specialize in first in world premieres and second productions and third productions.
Right.
And they have trained certain audiences to understand that what you're seeing is the first step or the second or third step in an evolution in the new ways that plays are being developed these days.
You know, another thing that I thought that was pretty, and I think this might have been slightly controversial, at least in the room, that Lauren said was that she's interested in knowing critics' biases, their perspective, you know, where they're coming from essentially when they write a review. And that's something that, I mean, I try to keep in mind. I have certain tastes myself, but I try not to, it's hard. It's a delicate line to walk between imposing your taste on people. Like, I just don't like this kind of play versus this isn't a successful production of this type of play. A couple of the things that Lauren was had on her wish list are difficult, like disclosing your biases constantly, sort of here's who I am and where I'm coming from, can be difficult to do in every review. But also, you know, she really said that it's worse for a playwright to feel like their play was misunderstood than the critic didn't like it. And so she was... one of the things she wanted was for critics to honor the playwright's intent. And I think where things got a little contentious there was, well, how can, you know, you can try to make an educated assumption about what the play is trying to do here. But what if you get it wrong? Is that a critic or an audience member's fault? I don't know. That's a trickier one, especially for like I'm a director's notes and playwright's notes and dramaturg notes reader.
Right.
But I know a lot of my colleagues aren't.
Right. And it's also, you can't expect an audience to do that as well, you know? At some level, the rubber has to meet the road, and they have to put on a show that people can understand without any preparation. I think that might be all we have time for, and I would just close with a note, which is Lauren's play, I and You, which won the Steinberg Award at Humana, is going to be published in the July-August issue of American Theater Magazine. So,
wonderful.
That's a happy bit of news. And this has been a happy conversation. I really appreciate both your time, and I thank our listeners for listening. This has been Rob Weinert-Kent at American Theater. Bill Hirschman, Aaron Keene, thanks very much.
Thanks,
Rob. Thank you for having us.
American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. Find us online at tcg.org/American Theater. That's theater with an R-E.